Welcome to Anurag Mahendra Sarma podcast. This is episode 60, where Professor Joyjit Pal will discuss about the history of social media and misinformation networks, how these misinformation networks in US are different from India. In India, people spread fake news through WhatsApp forwards, so it would be very interesting to understand that how does it happen in US. In this podcast, we'll also discuss about Elon Musk, whether he is a genius or a ruthless evil capitalist, and how his adventure or misadventures are related to what the Professor Joyjit Pal says, the frontier spirit of USA. We will also discuss about how TikTok is challenging the hegemony of American social media companies. And lastly, we'll discuss about the tech chaos and the future of job market in the era of mass firing. This might be perhaps the last podcast of this year. So I'm very happy to tell my listener that the podcast this year have been among top 1% most shared globally on the Spotify. Although these are numbers which are not necessarily enough to tell us about the emotional bond that this podcast forms with the listeners. But I think such achievements can be important for podcast which is working outside the corporate setup, which is exploring the themes that are not mainstream in India. So that also says a lot about the audience who are listening to the podcast and actively helping it to exist in the overcrowded domain of podcasts. I really want to thank all my listeners for continued support, to those who have supported it by donating generously on many different platforms. I'm really sorry that I'm often unable to send a reply note to people who donate because there is no option to reply back. But if you want to say something to me, then you can always email me on anuragmahendrasarma@gmail.com. So many of my listeners are students and also those who can't support the podcast financially. So I really want to thank them as well for actively being with the podcast through many different means. Podcast remains totally free to consume because I believe that any source of knowledge should be available to anyone who uses the internet. And I think this should be, in fact, the spirit of internet. But it remains very difficult to survive through this model when you are bypassing the brands, corporate, and their expectation and pressure to dictate how the podcast should be. So once again, I request those of wonderful listeners who are in position to afford and those who love this podcast to please support it on various mediums such as Patreon, which is a preferred medium, or InstaMojo that supports UPI, or Buy Me a Coffee, or PayPal for those who are living outside of India. Your support will be very crucial for the survival of the podcast in the upcoming year. So please do consider it. And now let's start episode number 60 of Anurag Mahendra Sarma podcast. So welcome to Anurag Mahendra Sarma podcast. This is episode 60 of the podcast, and today our guest is Professor Joyjit Pal. He is an associate professor at the University of Michigan. Prior to this, he was a senior principal researcher at Microsoft Research India. His recent work has been on the usage of social media in mainstream politics, particularly in India. As a part of this, he also studies misinformation networks and discourses. In the past, he has been a visiting scholar at the Research Center for Advanced Science and Technology, University of Tokyo in 2013, and at the Center on Democracy, Development and Rule of Law at Stanford University in 2015. So I met Professor Joyjit Pal at Michigan University, where he has invited me on a panel to talk about the podcast journey and the social media in general. We couldn't talk that much at that time because of the hectic schedule of the event. But this podcast seems like a nice place where we can have a conversation. In fact, where we can listen to his insight on American politics, culture, and changing dynamics of social media. So, Professor Joyjit Pal, first of all, welcome to Anurag Mahendra Sarma podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So my first question is about the networks of misinformation. For example, in India, we know that there are so many mediums of misinformation, be it WhatsApp, Twitter, Facebook or other social media networks. And these are the networks which are exploited by many different stakeholders to spread misinformation. So obviously the ruling party does it in a very extreme forms, but I think all ideologies somehow spread misinformation through these networks in their own way. Also in India, a lot many people think of internet, still think of internet since it is very new, that they think that whatever is on internet may be true. But the same situation is not in US, where people are accustomed to internet. It's not recent like in India. It started after that Jio revolution, or, you know. How then in US this idea of fake news, misinformation spread, and how the general public become a victim of it?
In terms of misinformation, it's important to back up a little bit to understand when people got on the internet for the first time. So an entire generation of people would have got on the internet with their first experience with cross-border communication, if you want to call it that, as being email. Okay, so I, for instance, my first experience with the internet was on email. And that is changing over time. So after some time, you see the next group of people, their first interaction with the internet was browsers. Then it became tablet screens. And then finally, now it is mobile interfaces like WhatsApp or so on and so forth. So if you ask a new internet user in India, what is the internet? Well, they think that YouTube and WhatsApp are internet. The reason why this is important is that people in the past, if they came on the internet, they understood what the Nigerian scam was, because it was the most pervasive scam of the old days, where someone would say on an email that they are a prince from some principality of Nigeria, their some grandfather has just died and left them a kingdom, but they need to set up some bank account for which you have to front some amount of money, and then once you do that, then you know, then you can take part of their get half of their inheritance, something ridiculous like that, right? Over time, this Nigerian scam stayed as a Nigerian scam. You might wonder, why are they still calling it a Nigerian scam? Why don't you represent it as something new, etc.? And the logic behind that was that they only wanted the most gullible people. So there's somebody who will fall for a scam, which so many people are seeing already, that if you're still willing to fall for without it being changed, then you are a good target, right? So it's a self-selection method. Anybody who replies to that is likely to fall for this, right? What we have now is that, especially in the aftermath of Jio and various other parts of the world where price of mobile has dropped dramatically, a lot of people have come online without the idea that you can be tricked, that information which is online is not necessarily all to be taken as truth. And this doesn't mean that those people are necessarily more gullible than anybody else. And it's very important to understand that you and I are exactly as likely to fall for misinformation as somebody else, given the right circumstances. To answer your question most directly, which is the most relevant point of misinformation and social media in the political sense, is what is called social misinformation. And that tends to be driven by a certain kind of misinformation being more comforting to your social group. Okay, so let us say you take that your social group is Bengalis, and then the neighboring social group is Oriya, and then there is this misinformation on Rasgulla is actually from Bengal. Now, you don't actually know the history of whether Rasgulla is from Bengal or not, but because you say, okay, I'm Bengali, I will say, okay, definitely this must be from Bengal, and you push that upwards, right? And so that is the most pervasive form of political misinformation, where people are willing to believe something bad about the next person because they see their group as somehow fundamentally being a threat from the other group. Okay, and the cases of this is, there was a great case of this when there was a poster of Subhash Chandra Bose. There was pictures of this online. Picture was of actually a movie star in West Bengal, and it was shown as though the president of India is unveiling this picture of the movie star as the real Subhash Chandra Bose. And liberals were very quick to say, oh, you know, look at this, this government is so stupid that they think this film star is Subhash Chandra Bose. And it was a great case of many people thinking that they were above misinformation, falling for misinformation, which aligns with their belief that the government is stupid, okay, or doesn't really care, or whatever it is. So this the same situation is probably true in the US, where we are seeing a huge level of polarization, where one group is willing to believe all kinds of ridiculous things about the other group. And this is not necessarily true that liberals are less likely to believe extreme things about conservatives than vice versa. But the discourse has definitely been driven by some of the more extreme cases, QAnon being the probably the most important one, which has in fact grown on Twitter in recent days, which believed that there is this large conspiracy involving pedophilia and a pizza shop in DC, which is sort of a shadow government for the country and all that. And there were a lot of right-wing extremists who believed in it and acted on it. So this kind of environment where a person sees someone else of a different political philosophy, not just as something different on one aspect of their lives, but as something which is just totally incompatible with your being, makes you much more willing to accept misinformation about them. And that is exactly what is happening in the US right now, is that politics is so divided that there is seen as no common ground, and anything extreme said about one side or the other is willingly accepted by the other side. And that obviously has political risks, but it also has real, real in-person risks, if you will, of the kind which is driven by, say, mass shootings. Several of the recent mass shooters have been known to engage in extreme in communities which engage in various forms of extreme misinformation.
Yeah, that's true, because a lot many people think that fake news only means right-wingers or conservatives. But I think there are many people, many liberals who have been maybe the victim of the fake news. For example, Nidhi Razdan became a victim of that Harvard scam. Or recently, those who have seen how Wire became became the victim of the fake news regarding that ex-checker story of Amit Malviya and all that. But my question initially was like, what are the networks of fake news? Like in India, it's WhatsApp. So in US, what are those networks where people actively spread fake news?
Dekhi, US mein toh it's okay. So firstly, whether it is misinformation or whether it is innuendo is an important question. So agar main kehta hoon ke yaar Anurag ne kuch 10 khoon kiye hai. Okay, that is misinformation. I hope so. If I say, kya Anurag ne 10 khoon kiye hai? Then that is innuendo. It's not explicit misinformation.
Yes.
And what we are seeing right now is that ye jo innuendo ka baat hai, ye har platform pe hai. It is going from television all the way down to direct interpersonal communication. If you look at Facebook and Facebook's most engaged news platforms on Facebook, okay? Number 1, 2, and 3 are Daily Wire, BBC, and Daily Mail of UK, okay? Of these, Daily Wire and Daily Mail are both completely overrun by misinformation, innuendo, and very tabloid-style news, all right? And these kinds of things have found a new way of finding buoyancy online, which they would not find in the normal old school way in which their content was consumed, which was in the US when you are standing in the checkout counter of a shopping market. So, aap India mein jab ye koi Reliance Fresh wagera mein jaate ho, to wo चेकआउट के बाहर समझिए वो कुछ समझिए कुछ फाइव स्टार वगैरह रखा है उधर, तो वो समझ लो कि जाते थे चल ये ले लेते दैट काइंड ऑफ थिंग. ओके, इन द यूएस दैट एलिमेंट वाज जस्ट बिफोर यू पुट योर थिंग्स ऑन दैट यू क्या बोलते हैं उसको यार वो कन्वेयर बेल्ट है जो डालने का उसके जस्ट आउटसाइड ऑफ दैट देयर यूज्ड टू बी दिस टैब्लॉइड्स डेली इंक्वायरर ऑल दीज काइंड्स ऑफ थिंग्स. And these were known for nonsense news. Okay, something like John F. Kennedy was actually murdered by aliens. Aisa kuch, huh? And those people used to read while they were waiting to check out. Theek hai? And people generally understood that, ah, yeah, this is a nonsense news, time pass. Okay, then there would be news about film stars are having affairs, etc., etc., that kind of things. What has happened is now that people have mobile phones, nobody picks them up. Because when you're standing in line to check out your groceries, you are looking at your mobile phone, you're scanning through whatever you're doing, that magazine is just lying there. So these magazines, which were basically spreading garbage, have had to refashion their business model. And one of the ways they've done it is by showing up on social media feeds. So really the question is it the medium which is doing it, or is it something which is much more centralized, which was just using the medium as a means of output? But what it is doing is it is doing the work of radicalizing. And once you have radicalized the people enough, then whatever else goes out there is fair game. So you have a mix of social media, you have extreme levels of hate and polarization on radio, which has actually been traditionally true for US. US mein actually, aap dekhne jaye to pehle aapka sawal ye agar hoye to where was the really aggressive misinformation or hate speech coming? It was always what is called talk radio. ठीक है? क्योंकि इनके पास talk radio, AM radio. ठीक है, ये जो चैनल्स आप चलाएंगे, ये वेदर इट इज रिलीजियस चैनल्स, वेदर इट इज हाईली पोलराइज्ड चैनल्स, दीज वर ऑल ऑन रेडियो. एंड पार्टली बिकॉज दे डिडंट हैव द फंडिंग टू गो ऑन टेलीविजन, एंड टेलीविजन वाज जनरली देयर वर सम स्मॉल नंबर ऑफ नेशनल ब्रॉडकास्टर्स, एनबीसी, सीबीएस, एबीसी एटसेट्रा, व्हिच वर सीन एज लार्जली न्यूट्रल, एंड देयर वर सम व्हिच वर सीन एज स्लाइटली मूविंग इन वन डायरेक्शन और द अदर. Fox News, when it started becoming more and more conservative, that drew the first set of true, highly conservative, highly polarized content on broad cable television. And what you're seeing now, which are people who are too radical for Fox News, they think that, nahin yaar, isme to sachai nahi boli jati, because ye bhi mainstream hai, ye bhi godi media, whatever they want to call it. They are going on podcasts, or they are going on these Daily Wire kind of websites, and they're getting plenty of content from there. In the US, it's not the same as in India, where there is one thread on WhatsApp which is moving from person to person. Yahan pe to, in fact, agar koi WhatsApp use karta hai, to aap beshak samajh sakte ho ki uska US ke bahar koi rishtedar hai, warna fir wo WhatsApp use hi nahi karega. Right, because over here, in general, people don't use it. People just text on whatever.
Interesting. But are podcasts so popular that they are reaching to general public? Like in India, it's still not that popular medium.
No, podcasts are fairly popular here. And besides podcasts being fairly popular, there is also something called Sirius Radio, which is high bandwidth satellite radio. And that also tends to be highly conservative leaning. And in a nutshell over here, most of the radical content tends to be more oriented towards white nationalists, who are perceiving this as a moment where they are losing power in society and marginalized from several states, etc. And so it's a kind of revivalist movement in that population. And, you know, and Trump came into the picture. He really gave a strong boost to that population, and which has, like I said, it's exists on now various mediums. It's not unusual, for instance, everybody has access to a mobile device, so it's very easy to plug that into your car stereo or listen to it at home. So that's fairly widespread.
One question I had is about the influence of social media, and especially in the times when, you know, there are so many changes are happening within the social media. So how influential, let's say, Twitter is still in the setting up the political discourse and changing the public perception? Because there are so many articles which are coming in recently, like one I read about the age of social media is over, which argues that these changes in tech, way the advertisers are moving out of Twitter and Zuckerberg is losing hundreds of billion, and there's an overall sense of general sense of user fatigue that suggests that social media may not be that relevant in the coming years. So how do you see these changes, especially in the economic changes that are happening behind the social media? And also, one question just to addition to that, like recently they have unbanned Trump on Twitter, but still the Trump is not that interested in coming back to Twitter. So what does it say about the influence of this platform on American politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in general, these things follow a kind of a wave, right? So no tech is permanent in that sense. If you think back to the late 1990s, there was, 6 degrees. I don't know if you remember or if you played around with that. Basically, it said you're 60 degrees away from anybody in the world, right? And people would get online to figure out, well, how many degrees am I away from whoever it is? And that's, of course, very central to LinkedIn's architecture today, right? Tells you how far you are from somebody. And then, you know, that died. Then Friendster came. Then Friendster vanished. And there was MySpace. Well, Friendster and MySpace were sort of at the same time. In fact, LinkedIn, I think, is probably the oldest one which is still in existence, right? But then there was other ones. High Five came. Then if you remember Orkut, when Orkut came, then that became the big thing. And every time when one of these was around, we thought, yeah, this will never go away. This is just so many people are using it. So many people are online. I mean, there were even people who on Google Plus who were posting there all the time, right? And at some point, the company decides, especially if it's a company which has multiple properties, like Google Plus in this case, and Orkut in this as well, that, okay, this is not sufficiently valuable for the overall state of the company, and then we might decide to get rid of it, okay? Now, what has happened with Facebook in particular is that the iOS decisions around profiling and ad spending around profiling has made a serious dent on Facebook. And this, of course, you know, relates to all the tech layoffs and the things that are happening around there. And what has also happened is TikTok has started eating dramatically into the overall mind space in terms of engagement with social media. So Instagram is suffering from TikTok's engagement. Twitter, of course, has started using TikTok very aggressively, where you see the viral content from TikTok shows up on Twitter. And so there's an overall deflation of American social media sites. Yeah. But on Twitter, the advantage that Twitter has is that it is the established, at this point, the preeminent means by which politicians do their outreach. And just because Trump is not doing his outreach on it, that doesn't mean that the mainstream politicians, whoever are there, now they've started to put all their communications on Twitter. Every journalist worth their salt is on Twitter for the most part in the States. And so what matters is what you're seeing on the news is highly driven by the content which is consumed by the journalist on Twitter. So in other parts of the world, the head of government might not even show up in front of a press room, right? in the US, Joe Biden, even Donald Trump, when he was at his most antagonistic relationship with the press, would still stand up in front of a press room and answer questions. He might have said some offensive thing afterwards, but on Twitter, but on the whole, wo nahi tha ki hum isse chupke baithenge. Whereas in many other parts of the world, you look at India, for example, kaun sa politician aake kuch bolta hai press ke samne. They are all sitting behind on Twitter. So if you are a journalist and if you have to do some kind of a news story on it, you have to take their sound bites from Twitter. So that has not gone away. That level of activity overall by politicians, because we study this thing, has not declined. Whether there is a change in perception of certain platforms is a different question. Whether we are at a moment where social media in and of itself is going to decline is also a different question, because social media as we knew it till, I would say, probably the explosion of Instagram was one-to-one social media. Means who are your contacts, or what is they called, the mutuals on Facebook, and what is the content that they are producing that you are consuming. Okay, so you are looking at pictures. Are ye Anurag to aaj chow mein kha raha hai, wah wah bahut acha. So you are commenting on those things because you are watching each other. That has changed to a broadcast medium where the majority of content people are engaging are from influencers, are from people who are producing the content for money. So the notion of social media as social, meaning me looking out for what you are doing, has been changed by the nature of how we understand engagement, where we care about who engages how much with our content, and vice versa, we want to engage with the content which is coming with the verification of the rest of the world that haan haan ye to bahut acha ye udi marne wala hai ye parts hai to chalo dekhte, everybody's watching it. So that nature of social media itself is now, it's a consumption media, it's not a exchange media in that sense, and obviously Meta itself is looking at Facebook as a declining platform, which is why it's playing with things like metaverse, etc. So there is definitely a lot of validity to this idea that social media as we know it is going through a dramatic change and decline, but certain elements of social media have become broadcast media, and Twitter as a news source is definitely far from going away. If anything, it continues to be the preeminent source of news even after Elon Musk's takeover.
बट इट्स इंटरेस्टिंग कि अगर जो जिनकी मोनोपोली है यूएस कंपनीज की, जो हमेशा रही है सोशल मीडिया के ऊपर, और टिकटॉक उनको पूरी तरह से चैलेंज कर रहा है, देन व्हाई इज यूएस गवर्नमेंट नॉट डूइंग एनीथिंग टू यू नो उसके पर काटने के लिए. जैसे फॉर एग्जांपल इंडिया में तो उठा के बैन ही कर दिया सीधा चल के, तो डू यू थिंक यूएस में इस तरह क्यों नहीं कर रहे कि हमारी मोनोपोली चले और टिकटॉक आके हमें कैसे रूल कर सकता है.
हाँ, ये एक्चुअली थोड़ा कॉम्प्लिकेटेड है, बिकॉज yes, I mean, it's not unheard of. Actually, I don't know if you track this, but there is like a serious trade war going on between US and China right now over semiconductors, and US blocking semiconductor access to China. And before that, US has, banned or sanctioned Chinese companies, including Huawei, etc. The problem with TikTok is that it is too enmeshed in the American sense of free speech today. So if you were to ban TikTok, then you have a bunch of people who are like, wait, what happened here? Why is this being banned? So unless the government is able to conclusively show that ye data chori karke ye kya jo bhi kar rahe, they can't just say that ha ye hamara anti-competitive hai. It's not even anti-competitive. It is competitive. In fact, in every fair sense of the word, they are beating American companies at their own game. TikTok is challenging Google on search. I mean, that is unthinkable, that nobody has challenged Google on search in decades. Really? At this point. Yes, it's challenging Google on search for certain kinds of things, like people who want to look for ways of doing certain things, like
makeup or something like
that. So that is completely now moved on to TikTok, and which is a very interesting change. So the US government can't just say that, yeah, ye Chinese company, ye hamare company se zyada acha karta hai, to chalo ye. Because for most part, I mean, then are you going to say that, FTX is a Caribbean company? Well, I mean, a lot of these companies have their headquarters based wherever the hell it is.
Bahamas, yeah.
Bahamas, wagera, right? So this is true for a lot of companies in the past which had an antagonistic relationship at a country level with the US. Toyota being a great example. When Toyota first came, started selling cars in the US, there was a really antagonistic relationship between US and Japan. And there were people like, don't buy Japanese cars. You buy a Japanese car, tum parking lot pe rakhoge, koi anda phekega us pe. That kind of relationship was there. And so Japan set up operations in the US and then brought out the case that we are making jobs for Americans. And so in some sense, TikTok is in the same space. There is no real legitimate argument for what would be the basis of banning it unless you're able to show that the company is doing something shady.
But how do you look at these recent changes that are happening at Twitter, especially jab se Elon Musk hai, like what do you think he... चल क्या रहा है वो कभी $8 का ट्विटर है कभी ये बैन होगा कभी वो होगा आई मीन इट्स कंप्लीट फ्रॉम अ डिस्टेंस इट लुक्स कंप्लीट केओस व्हाट डू यू थिंक ही इज ट्राइंग टू डू विद ट्विटर एंड डू यू थिंक विल ही बी सक्सेसफुल एंड व्हाट एवर ही इज थिंकिंग ऑल्दो वी डोंट नो व्हाट ही इज थिंकिंग बट स्टिल
Yeah, so again, this is partly tied in with the overall flattening in tech, which has been happening of late, which has longer history for why that's going on. But in Elon Musk's case, one thing that everybody should recognize here is that he has shaved down dramatically the number of people who are working on Twitter. And just about every day, we have heard that Twitter is going to crash. And we have not seen it crash. And that should be a very telling sign to you that I think this is a sign of how tech might go in the future, which is more and more firms believing that they can operate their entire their company at a much smaller number of people hired than they have already. So let's take aside two things. One is what Elon Musk is doing to the organization of Twitter and how many people work there, what are their functions, etc. And the second is what is he doing to the output on Twitter? Okay. Now, for all practical purposes, Elon Musk's and the kinds of things that he says on Twitter, he would probably be banned in the old Twitter. Like most recently, his attacks on
Fauci.
Yes, and Fauci would be cases of attempt to engineer
targeted
action against targeted attacks against these people, right?
Mm.
So. What Elon Musk as a central figure, which he was an important figure, but he is not that kisne apne pichle ek hafte mein Elon Musk ka naam nahi dekha hai Twitter pe. Aisa ho hi nahi sakta. Tum kahin jak maar ke gaon mein Twitter ka account chalu karoge to tumhare ko ek Elon Musk ka tweet dik jayega, uspe upar koi controversy dik jayega. So the point is that he has become such a dominant figure in the discourse that in and of itself is worth talking about, like what that does to the platform to have an owner of the platform where the owner is so much in your face, right?
Yes.
So you could say that, okay, there is perhaps the only place where the owner of a platform is so much in your face might be Narendra Modi. Uska thoda dekhe bina apan kahin ja hi nahi sakte, kahin airport mein jayega, idhar jayega, toh wo Modi hai idhar. So in the sense that this is one case where the nature of the organization being private has really been put in the faces of everyone who was using that platform. And has been extremely painful for those who were users of the platform who were particularly not Musk follower or did not like Musk. Now they are all like stuck having to watch Musk. And Musk clearly from his past engagements enjoys this kind of supervillain status, right? He really likes rubbing people the wrong way. He likes firing people, shaming them, etc., etc.
Isn't it a recent thing or it has been happening since very long? Because earlier, at least in India, we used to think of him as some kind of a visionary and who was mostly silent. He was not speaking that much. I think first unusual image was that when he came to Joe Rogan podcast and smoked that weed, and that time it changed a little for people. So like, was it always like that, or is it a certain change in his persona?
Well, so for one, smoking weed on a podcast is over here. It's not such a big deal, but yeah, but in India, also like in India maybe. Yeah, so that's one part of it. The second part of it is that, see, let us not dispute the fact of whether or not he's a visionary, because even if you say that he does not have the engineering chops or he simply hired the right staff to work with him, etc., etc., this is not some Sam Bankman-Fried. This is not a lowly fraud. This is a person who has actually built a couple of companies which would be by no trivial level of scientific expertise, of an expectation of how markets would react, of an understanding of global pulse on certain issues. And he has been at the front of leading that multiple times. So you cannot deny the fact that he's a visionary. You also probably cannot deny the fact that he is an asshole, because the kind of things that he does online is things which are intended to mess with people. And whether you think that every visionary is necessarily a jerk, like there is a bunch of people who would say that, you know, Steve Jobs looks like the worst person in the world to work with, or Bill Gates looks like the worst person to have as the boss or whatever. And many of these things are probably true, but that doesn't detract from the fact that the person might also be a visionary and very competent at what they do. Now, with Twitter, I think it has given a certain ability to his most negative instincts and really accentuated that in front of us rather than whatever else he's doing. And some of these are outright stupid, right? To ask somebody to show their code, That just is not how code works. You can't look at my code and say, "Haan, ye tumne pichle hafte kya kiya?" Nahi yaar, ye pichle hafte to main sirf ye debugging kar raha tha. So you have not written any code. Okay, come on, get out of the office. So this is
he's firing like people like that.
Well, he's asking people to show up with their code. That just isn't okay. How you work with code, right? So It's not like a classroom where you're given a particular assignment and you go out and do this. So there's some elements of that which make him look like he's stupid, but none of us are inside the room. And even the people who are major detractors, including Yoel Roth, for instance, has said relatively good things about him as well. All right. Now, that being said, you have to understand that Elon Musk had a stepwise increase in persona, in broad acceptability over several years. US may, Bill Gates has said wonderful things about Elon Musk. Okay? Donald Trump has said wonderful things about Elon Musk. Neil deGrasse Tyson has said wonderful things about Elon Musk. So this means that you can see that somebody who is held up as an icon for the left, well, you know, Bill Gates, at least before his sexual misdemeanors were put out there, was a major icon for business as well as like liberal philanthropy, etc. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's like a really kind of iconic figure as a black academic in the US and somebody who does really high quality output on television, etc. And of course, Trump, who's on the other end of the spectrum. And all these figures saying that this guy is one of the greatest visionaries we've ever seen. So this reputation was well in place much before he came onto Twitter. And with liberals, he was already a hero for putting out the Tesla. देखिए आप ये बात समझ लीजिए कि टेस्ला ने व्हाट हैज हैपेंड टू द यूएस ऑटोमोबाइल मार्केट बिकॉज ऑफ टेस्ला इज दैट एवरी कंपनी हैज नाउ स्टार्टेड मेकिंग electronic vehicles. Now you can say, well, was it because of Tesla? Was it because of regulation or credits being offered to companies? Blah, 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 blah. What a lot of things in there. But the point is that it has changed the nature of automotive experience in the United States. And the car is genuinely a very, that there are certain like really great things about the car, the way it picks up, etc. Okay, and also realize that in the past that one, when one person was really, really wealthy and wanted to show off mere paas kitna paisa hai, wo Porsche khareedta tha, theek hai? Wo Porsche khareedta tha, aur wo Porsche abhi, that car is not the car of choice of the wealthy people who want to show up for the simple reason that ye gear wala gaadi clutch to kisi ko maloom hi nahi hai kaise chalane ka. तो पोर्श लेके क्या करेगा वो, उसको गियर शिफ्ट करना नहीं आता है. सो नाउ एवरीबॉडी इज ओके, द पर्सन हु इज रियली वेल्थी, दे आर गेटिंग अ टेस्ला. दैट ड्राइविंग एक्सपीरियंस इज दैट ऑफ अ टेस्ला. सो एंड यू इमीडिएटली एसोसिएट द टेस्ला विद इलॉन मस्क. सो ही इज कमिंग इन विद दिस रेप्यूटेशन, ही इज कमिंग इन विद द पर्सन हु सेंट अ रॉकेट अप इन द स्काई एंड मेड इट लैंड, which is unheard of, right, before this. And while it is unheard of before this, it seems like a pretty simple logic. Well, why was it unheard before this? Simply because nobody with the vision said that. And he is somebody who's talking about living on Mars. Well, you and I might think that's a ridiculous idea, but somebody's out there thinking about it. And so you learn to fear and awe someone who brings out that nature of discourse. And that is what Trump, that's a, you know, interesting mix up, what Elon Musk has brought as an entrepreneur in this country. Yeah.
That's interesting.
I'm not sure if I answered your question or went into a...
No, you did. It was very interesting. But just to add up to that, I'm also curious to know that what the average general public of US thinks about these kind of ruthless billionaire, let's say, who are extremely ruthless, who are openly jerks, and you know, we don't care about humility or, you know, being humble or anything. For example, in India, this idea of humility, which mostly is fake, but is considered as a very good thing about billionaires, like people like Narayan Murthy or Ratan Tata, because they are humble, they are giving job to people and whatever. At least that image of them is built like that and people like it. So does it concern people of the US when these billionaires behave in such kind of ways in which shows no kind of empathy to their worker or people in general?
So this is a very good question, because this is at the heart of what is referred to as the frontier spirit in the United States. Okay? In the 19th century, when immigrants would come to the United States, they would be allotted a piece of land by the government somewhere in the frontier. When I'm saying frontier, I mean that, so you think about the US growing from Virginia or the East Coast all the way to the West Coast, slowly, 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 slowly. Okay? So the East Coast was populated, fir thode thode log aur bahar jane gaye, then you went across the Appalachian to the other side.
Can you name one or two major cities so that people in India would get the context of East and West? Because I don't think people...
So the traditional East Coast of the US would be states like Massachusetts, Virginia, New York. New York is, of course, like an iconic city. When you think about immigration to the US, you think about people showing up at the port in New York with suitcase and all that. So, वहाँ पे पहुँच गए, अभी यहाँ से कहाँ जाएंगे, right? So, traditionally, people were moving up and down the east coast of the US along the Atlantic Ocean. And then slowly there was a growth of plantation economy in the south of the United States, but that was largely seen as a exploitative economy driven on the backs of slave labor. The frontier economy was when the US slowly started moving inwards into what is called the Midwest of the U.S., partly because there was like wars that U.S. and wars with France, which brought a new bunch of territory into the United States. And then eventually there was a war with Mexico, which brought California, New Mexico, etc. into the United States. So aap samajh lijiye ki ye desh aiste aiste badhte ja raha hai from one small area in the east side of the country all the way till the west coast to what is today California. ठीक है? और ये जो आहिस्ते आहिस्ते बढ़ते जा रहा है तो यहाँ पे कोई रहने वाले लोग नहीं है. तो क्या हो रहा है कि रहने वाले लोग नहीं है, रह रहे हैं लोग देयर हु आर नेटिव अमेरिकन्स, लेकिन उसकी कोई इज्जत नहीं है इन द यूएस गवर्नमेंट एट दैट पॉइंट. सो जो भी नया आ रहा है उसको एज अ वे ऑफ डिवेलपिंग दोज लैंड्स विच वर टूवर्ड्स द वेस्ट ऑफ द कंट्री, दे द यूएस गवर्नमेंट स्टार्टेड जस्ट गिविंग पार्सल्स ऑफ दैट लैंड टू पीपल हु वुड कम, एंड दैट दोज पार्सल्स ऑफ लैंड वर almost always given to white people. ठीक है? तो आप समझ लीजिए कि आप आए हो यहाँ पे नए देश में, आपके पास कुछ है नहीं वगैरह वगैरह, लेकिन आपको एक चिट्ठी दिया जाता है कि ठीक है ये एक ये स्क्वायर प्लॉट है, ये यहाँ वो एकदम अंदर है, किधर जाके वहां पे जो करना है करो. सो दैट हैज अ रियली वैल्यूएबल portrayal in the US history where somebody would go to a totally new piece of land, wahan pe animals hai, ped pooch hai, jo bhi hai, and there are aggressive Native Americans jiska land actually tumhe diya gaya hai, jisko malum nahi tha ki yaar mera jameen abhi iska iske naam pe hai. You have to get rid of all these and then build a farm over there, build a ranch over there. Okay. So that was seen as a very manly, a frontier spirit that you go into an unknown space, you conquer that space. So this notion of individualism, which comes in the US, is very tied to this frontier spirit of going there and making it on your own. So whereas in India, we have a much more of a communalist spirit in which we say that, haan, tum ye ho, tumhare marwadi ho, to tu baki marwadi community ke liye kya kar rahe ho, ye naye jagah mein gaye ho, wahan pe kis kis ko leke aa rahe ho, vagera vagera. Here it was that main wahan pe gaya hu, main, my family, I am going to build something for us. And that was a line of respect that you would get out of that. So historically, the US has had what is called the robber barons. So jisne pehle pehle ye railroads set up kiye US mein, those people were highly exploitative people who used slave labor, Chinese labor to set up railroads in terrible conditions, and they became extremely rich. And today Stanford University is basically the named after somebody who was a robber baron. Right. So similarly, there are other people who are iconic in the US, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers. These are names that you will hear, the Fords. These are names that you will hear around the world with foundations and this and that. And these people in their lifetimes were among the worst type of people, including Andrew Carnegie, who set up a foundation because he was such a bad person that he wanted to offset it in some way. Okay. So we have a history, and this is actually, I'm not pulling this out of my hat. This is very well documented in his own story. So we have a history of respecting people jisne duniya ko apne mutthi pe laya hai. The question, the notion of taming, you tame a horse, you tame the land. In the same way, these people who built empires, they tamed the environment for themselves. And Elon Musk is a continuity of that frontier spirit.
Interesting.
He has tamed the market for electronic vehicles. He has built something which did not exist. He is going to be seen as the person who has tamed Mars, which in my lifetime, I don't expect to see. But, you know, what am I? So that explains why he just has such respect from one quarter of people who see his abusive behavior online as a reaction to this kind of liberal empathy, if you will, for people who are different from themselves, because that is seen as diluting the American culture of individualism.
That's very interesting. And in fact, that also explains the foreign policy of of US, like the way it goes into other nation and everything.
Yeah, that is the notion of US exceptionalism, which US has traditionally believed that US is somehow better than the rest of the world. And therefore, the values that the US espouses is something that it can and should impose onto others. But of course, that has a longer history with empire and colonialism, right? So then you have the notion of the dark continent in Africa, and jo gore log wahan pe ja rahe ye inko seedha karne ke liye ja rahe, and that is considered as something that the white people are giving as a donation to the poor black people of Africa or India or whatever it is. So that's, I would say, that is slightly different, because that is the notion of empire coming from your leadership rather than coming from individual people who work against the system. This is a very important distinction. So in the empire, still the central figure is the government. Here, it is the central figure is the entrepreneur who works despite the government. So the notion of small government and why that is such a central part of US public discourse is exactly the same thing which makes somebody like Elon Musk such a massive figure, because he shows that you can, or at least appears to show, which is kind of like very ironic, because wo Tesla jinda hai to wo subsidy bhi jinda hai, so that you can do this without the government supporting you, without the rest of the automobile industry supporting you. So it's slightly different than what is called the white man's burden in traditional sense.
But he also says a lot about killing the woke virus and making fun of pronouns and everything. So I was also interested to know, in general, is there general sense of disgust of people against social justice warriors, or that quote-unquote, loose term, I would say, woke culture and these kind of thing, which he is cashing on? Is that a general mood of American people?
Oh, that's definitely true. I think the election of Barack Obama was a foundational moment in that, because for one set of Americans, that settled the race question. If Barack Obama can get elected president, then clearly we are not a racist country. That's the kind of idea. And what happened alongside the election of Barack Obama is also a dramatic rise in a liberal discourse which embraced diversity. Okay, and so when Barack Obama stood for election in 2008. At that time, he was asked, is he for gay marriage? And he and Joe Biden at the time said, no, we're not for gay marriage. Okay. In 4 years during his second re-election, that time he had changed his tone a little bit. But the point is that both the issues of race as well as the issues of sexuality, these are the two big sticking points in conservative America. Both of these were seen as taking off during the Obama period, okay? And so as a result, when the Obama period died down and the rejection of Hillary Clinton, which definitely had a significant amount of misogynistic content, was both of these were seen as sort of marking moments with the late Obama period as being the period where we started talking about gender as gender issues as beyond just like LGBT, where we were talking about transgender issues. So all these things became sticking points among the conservative right, because it seemed to impinge upon that frontier spirit, that individualist spirit of how we want to be treated and how we want to treat others. So this notion that you call somebody by their pronouns, where you do for them what they want done in terms of how they wish to be treated, this was seen as a major sticking point. There is also this sense among especially the Christian right, where that requiring to treat people equally for, say, commercial services. So the big case which broke was one around a cake. Some gay couple wanted to buy a cake for their wedding, and then this baker said that they refused to do it because it's against their values. And it became a major sticking point where several of these cases have gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, where you can argue, well, is this something which, on the basis of my values, can I reject this? And in the same way that hospitals started saying, well, we are a Christian hospital, we don't believe in abortion, and therefore we will not provide the service. So this tussle between what is considered individual rights versus what is considered communitarian rights was something which escalated in the late Obama period, where Obama, ironically, would be referred to repeatedly as a dictator. And this was in some part because under Obama, both the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate were Republican, but Obama still managed to push through a lot of his agenda. So he was considered as dictating to the U.S. people how they should be treating other people in their communities, right? And ironically, when Trump came about, he was seen as the antithesis to Obama, which in many ways he is. But he said, speak your mind freely. If you think Muslims should be banned from entering, stop Muslims from entering. So when Trump first said, ban Muslims, people are like, what the hell? How can a president say that, or presidential candidates say that? Even Republicans were shocked by it. Then when he referred to El Salvador and Honduras as shithole countries, they were like, wow, who says something like that being a president? But he broke the rules, and people appreciated him for breaking the rules because he was exactly that frontier person. And it is a dramatic shift away from the leader who tries to be someone who holds up a certain set of values that they want you to accept, to somebody who says, I'm going my way, you can follow me if you wish, or you can go your way and I'll still respect you for going your way. And the Make America Great Again brought out this notion of a unified idea of what will make America great. And it was this powerful America which goes into places and looks for its own interests, irrespective of what are the global interests. Case in point, climate change. Okay? The climate is, well, A, we don't accept that there is climate change. In the United States, that was like the Trumpian argument. And B, even if there's climate change, is this going to hurt us? Like it was a complete shift away from a discourse where you're talking about, like, yes, what is good for the planet? We are all in this together. There's a, no, make America great again. If Mexico goes to hell, well, then so be it. Build a wall around America so that the Mexicans can't jump over when everything that they have falls to dust because of whatever, whether it's NAFTA, climate, or whatever it is. So it was a real change in nationalist argument because Trump completely focused on domestic versus global, which was what Obama was. And so if you want to understand where today's discourse is, really you have to think back to Obama and how that changed everything.
Interesting. So just one final question about these companies that are firing people in US. So many companies are seizing the new recruitment. So how is this situation of recession and the job market, or let's say, and what could be the repercussions in country like India? Let's say I am a new graduate or looking for a job. So do you think what kind of situation it is going to be in the job market, in the tech field in the coming years? Is it something to be extremely worried about?
So the layoffs which have happened right now are driven by a range of factors, the most important being the pandemic itself and the hiring that followed the pandemic, right? So then you have this pandemic set up this huge amount of people sitting at home and using technology, which increased the amount of demand there was for data. So data services skyrocketed. So you saw the shares of all the companies which were in data services just go through the roof. You're looking at Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook just had remarkable increases in valuation during that period. And so they ended up hiring a lot of people. And what has essentially happened is both that that perceived expansion in demand has been seen to be untrue. And so some of that has led to layoffs in these companies. And in particular, in the social media space, that has, so in data space, that has been true. So reducing back the number of people got hired then. And social media space has also been true because Metaverse has kind of fallen on its face. Nothing's really happened there. And the expansion of Facebook was literally at some point of time willing to hire you at twice of what you were making at one of the other major companies to move into its expansion around Metaverse, right? So that reduction which has happened is partly driven also by the question which you asked earlier, which is that are people less interested in social media? Clearly, Meta thinks that Facebook is at a risk of not being the same long-term project that it was. And this is also driven by iOS's decision, for instance, of not letting Facebook monetize people's data, for example, right? So that changes your revenue model as a major company. So there is these things which are happening, which are affecting companies and what are their projected revenues for coming quarters, which is driving down both their demand for new hires and also, like, you know, shaving down what they have. But these same companies, they are not bleeding money, okay? And this is a very, very important point. Ye hume bataya jata hai ki ye jo tech company hai, ye parivar hai, theek hai? You come to this company and now you are part of this great family of whatever these people are, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not, the company is the people who work there. And this has been exposed completely by this recent move of layoffs, where companies which were not losing money per se, they could have replaced that person and put them into other tasks if necessary. Google had a very good history of doing this, is that even when somebody was kind of redundant, they would just figure out somewhere else to put the person, because the overall quality of life for everyone who joins Google to see themselves as part of this firm and that as being an important sense of identity was something that they wanted to preserve. Okay, so that myth has largely been punctured in the US, for one. And in India, you can argue that myth was never there, because India mein jo aap attrition rates dekhte ho, okay, in the major companies, they are in the range of 20-25%. Matlab 25% aapke log company change kar rahe, theek hai? So there is not that, haan, main Infosys hu, main roj iska t-shirt banke ghumne wala hu raste pe. So it's not that same sense of community or identity that people feel with a company. So however, the decline in hiring has not moved the graph from where it would have been if the huge spike in pandemic period had not happened. Okay, so essentially we are seeing a correction of the market rather than a dramatic decline. But there are certain elements which are nonetheless important to keep in mind, which is that what does this do to the future of people who are mid-level management, who are being paid a certain amount of money, not necessarily in a very strictly controlled monetary sense of how much is this person worth to me. Yeah, so somebody who works on commission, well, clearly, how much is this person worth to me is dictated by their commission. But salaries are otherwise kind of arbitrary. And the notion is that as somebody stays in the firm longer and longer, you pay them more and more. That notion is going to change as the notion of employee stocks. These things have been completely changed by what has happened in the last 1 year, both in terms of the inflation that happened during 2021, when you went to, if you got a job in 2021, you got a deal which was unthinkable, even for a few months ago from there, to what is happening now, where Elon Musk is setting an example by saying that everybody who works for me has to expect that they're going to work weekends.
Hardcore
work. Everybody who's working, yes, is hardcore work. Everybody who's working for me should understand that I am waking up from under the table at 7 a.m. when they're showing up for their shift. Agar main aisa hu, to tum kaun ho? The Japanese kind of work culture where everyone will sit in the office until the boss leaves, so that after that they can say that, haan, boss se jyada kaam kiya main. Right? So if the work culture moves from one in which your company is constantly telling you that work-life balance, are you to work-life balance or DEI initiatives ke niche doob jaoge if you went to a US company in like a couple of years ago. And now Elon Musk is changing that rule. He's saying that, nah, what work-life balance? You want to work, you have to do great things. And the only way you will do great things is that you ignore your weekends, you ignore your family. This is what we want. And that sense of what it means to be a productive member of a tech firm has implications for everywhere in the world. Traditionally, it was the Europeans who kept us in line. Aap kisi company mein kaam kar rahe ho, aapko raat ko 2 baje phone lena padega because aapka partner US mein, to India wala to wo pani peeke baitha rahega 2 baje tak, to somehow or the other stay awake. You will not get a European to stay on the call if it is scheduled after 4:30 p.m. in their time, because their work culture is particularly different. India tends to pick up the work culture which is told to us from US. The US mein wo sara raat kaam kar rahe hain, apan bhi sara raat kaam karenge. And if there is a continuity from your engineering college days where you were sitting up all night and working, then you will continue that into your. Yes. This is a kind of a unconscious priming which will seep into the Indian work culture. I mean, there is talk of layoffs, etc. Right? Cognizant was doing layoffs, and there are other firms which are integrated into the US social media economy in particular, which are going to see some of these things happening. And so it's not like the Indian companies are outside, are safe from some amount of backpedaling. But my concern is more for the longer term impacts of what this will do to the culture of work. And that, of course, you know, remains to be seen. One company and one leader doing that is not a frame for the rest of the organization. But there's clearly, like, there's a very masculine style in the way that he's doing it, right? So you can't... women at work are not going to be able to do some of the same things that young males at work are going to be doing. What does that do to the notion of diversity at workplaces? Mm. So these things really are left to be answered.
Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Jorjit Pal. It was very fantastic to listen to you, to listen to your insight. I learned a lot from this conversation. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming to the podcast and taking out your time.
Thank you, Anurag.
So this was today's podcast. Please support it on various platforms such as Patreon, Buy Me a Coffee, Insta Mojo, or PayPal. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast.